Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, bringing you shows from radio's golden age. I'm your host, Mark Levanier, with you for an hour of science fiction. Later on, we hear Dimension X with Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, but right now, it's Robert A. Arthur's story, You Died Last Night, heard on Suspense. Originally produced for The Mysterious Traveler, the sci-fi tale was heard on CBS Radio on April 1st, 1962, and stars Robert Reddick and Santos Ortega.
And now, a tale well calculated to keep you in... In a moment, Act One of You Died Last Night, starring Bob Reddick and Santos Ortega, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur.
My name, Joe Prescott. Occupation, garage mechanic, age 34, unmarried, nobody ever heard of before. But I have a question for you. What happened to you last night? Now, don't answer, because whatever you say, you're wrong. All of you. You see, I know what happened last night. Because I saw it happen. You and you and you and all of you. You died last night. All right, let's start over. And don't bother to say I'm off my rocker. I'm going to tell you what happened. And I'm going to do my best to make all of you believe it, because if you don't, all of you, I got a pretty good idea you're going to die again some night soon. So we go back 2 days to the day before yesterday, time exactly 4 p.m., place 30 miles northeast of Bakersfield, California. Characters, just me, Joe Prescott and Nellie, my pack mule. I was prospecting like I do every year for a couple of weeks for the fun of it. Only this time I'd struck something that looked big. Because I didn't have anyone else to talk to, I talked to Nellie. Nellie, old girl, looks like you'll be able to retire. This is as big as I think it is. That's right, laugh. But this time I mean it. I'm going to blow a hole in this ridge and see what's down there. A nice big hole. About 12 sticks of dynamite. I tied Nellie to a tree, and then I drilled a hole. I put in 12 sticks of dynamite. I attached a 60-second fuse and lit it. And then I heard the noise. And out of no place, I saw it appear. A kind of blur above the rocks, like a spinning top. I knew I wasn't imagining it because Nellie heard it, too. All right, easy, Joe. Easy, easy. Easy. And there it was. Sitting on the rocks where I just planted the dynamite. A spaceship. An honest-to-gosh flying saucer half as big as a house. I acted automatically, not even thinking, put my foot on the fuse and crushed out the spark. And then I looked at this thing, goggle-eyed. An opening appeared near the ground and something came out. It looked sort of like a fuzzy orange teddy bear, 5 feet tall. It had two eyes raised on long stalks, and those eyes looked at me. And I looked at them. And then this teddy bear spoke to me.
Hello, Joe. What do you know?
Sure, it sounds funny, but that's what this thing said to me. It's funny because there's a slang line that I use myself, and the teddy bear had just plucked it right out of my mind, along with all the other words that I knew.
Please do not be frightened, Joe. I just want some information.
I believed it. And I relaxed. The teddy bear nodded.
That's better, Joe. How about coming inside the ship with me?
I crawled inside and he followed. The lens-like opening closed and I was in... Well, I suppose it was a control room. It had some dials, some screens like television screens, and a couple of overstuffed toadstools that turned out to be sort of chairs. And while I was looking around, the teddy bear started taking off his orange skin.
Easy, Joe. Don't panic. This is just a spacesuit I'm wearing. Naturally, it doesn't look like your spacesuit. I can't breathe your air. The nitrogen would poison me.
You can breathe my air, though. The nitrogen is replaced by something inert. There. Do I look any better to you?
Well, now he certainly looked more human. Though I don't guess he was. Anyway, not exactly. Out of the orange spacesuit, he looked like a 5-foot-tall old man wearing some flowing green material. He was bald, had pointed ears. He had large green eyes that seemed friendly.
Good. Now you're not afraid anymore. Incidentally, what you are thinking of is my ears are really, antennae. Like your moths.
Antennae, huh?
Yes. Ordinarily, I could use my antennae to hear your thoughts. But your human thought pattern seems so different from ours that we'd better use speech. Now that I've picked enough words out of your mind, and, why don't you call me Tony? Joe?
Mm-hmm. Sure. But Tony what?
Just Tony. Short for Thonian. That's what we call ourselves, Thonians. Just as you call yourselves humans.
So you're from outer space?
Yes. About 15 light years away. And it seems I got here just in time.
I don't get you. What do you mean, just in time?
To take the necessary steps, Joe.
Necessary steps for what?
A few hours ago, our Galactic Survey Bureau picked up radioactive waves coming from space. We located them in this solar system, and I was sent here immediately. Apparently, about 15 years ago, you humans exploded a quantity of radioactive material for the first time.
Yeah, I guess so. The first atom bomb.
That means you humans have discovered the secret of atomic energy. It won't be long before you're building spaceships and traveling to the stars.
I suppose you're right.
You see, we Thonians are rather set in our ways. We like peace and quiet. Frankly, we've had a lot of trouble with younger races who discovered atomic energy and came journeying through the universe trying to conquer everything in sight.
Yes, I can see how that might happen. They'd rather fight than be friends, huh?
Much too often. So now we just prevent trouble before it starts. I'm here to find out what the human race is like. If it doesn't measure up, I may have to take drastic action.
That's what he said. Drastic action. Meaning that if he didn't like our looks, he was going to destroy the human race before it could ever get dangerous to the Thonians.
Now, Joe, you mustn't be upset. It may not come to that. I'm here to take corrective action, yes. But I can decide whether it will be mild, severe, or drastic.
Mm-hmm. And what does mild mean?
Oh, blow up all atomic energy installations.
And what would drastic be?
That would involve turning your world into a ball of flaming gas.
That's nice.
But it's hardly ever necessary.
Oh, that's a consolation. So what is the other possibility? Severe measures.
I'd say eradicate all large cities and towns.
You mean wipe them out?
Remove them from existence.
And kill a few 100 million human beings?
Oh, more than that. Reduce the population of the world to, say, 50 million people and let them rebuild. But believe me, Joe, it would be quick and painless.
Oh, just like that, huh? Kill off most of the population and leave a few to rebuild?
Really, it's not as bad as you think. You could think of it as, what's the word I want? Pruning.
You mean like fruit trees?
Exactly. Sometimes races need pruning, too. And I'm afraid that from the Thonian viewpoint, the human race badly needs pruning. Yes, Joe. Rather badly.
There you have it. Here was Tony, a representative of a super race from the stars, come to our Earth in a super spaceship to destroy us. And what could I do about it? Nothing. I grabbed for the revolver that I always carry when I'm prospecting, but Tony turned those big green eyes on me and I froze, paralyzed like a statue.
You see, Joe? You're helpless. Please accept the inevitable. It'll be better that way.
Okay, Tony. What choice do I have? Well, what now? When do the festivities start?
Festivities? Oh, you are being humorous. You mean, when do I begin corrective measures?
That's right. I suppose you have ray guns, bombs, stuff like that to do your dirty work?
Joe, if only you wouldn't use words like dirty work. If you could just think of it as a necessary and helpful pruning.
Yes, well, I can't. Let's keep it on a high plane. Suppose I say preventive measures.
Well, it does sound better, I must admit. Well, to answer your questions, I do have a store of bombs. Very small, but very efficient. I don't carry any armaments as such. My ship is very light and delicate. It's built for speed, not for fighting. But then, we Tholians haven't had to fight anyone for the last million years.
Killed off the opposition before it got started, huh?
I guess you could put it that way. Later, the other races we've dealt with have grown up to be mature and peaceable. So there are no wars, interplanetary or otherwise.
I get the picture. I don't say I like it, but I get it.
Splendid. I'm favorably impressed by your quickness, Joe. Perhaps the human race is better than I think. But now let's start out on our tour of inspection.
Inspection?
Of your Earth. I have to make it before I decide what preventive measures to take. Mild, severe, or drastic.
Tony pushed some buttons. The walls of the spaceship became transparent. It's as if we were sitting in midair, and then we began to move, drifting up and away. I saw Nellie, my pack mule, raise her head and hee-haw after us. And then we were zipping over the mountains until they were only a blur under us. I began to ask Tony questions about how the ship worked, looking for an angle, anything that might help. Tony, how... Did you say that it was only a few hours ago that your race first knew an atomic bomb had been set off on Earth?
4 hours and, let me see, 48 minutes by your time, Joe.
And you covered 15 light years in under 5 hours? How could you do that? I thought nobody could travel faster than the speed of light.
They can't, Joe. But you see, this ship travels both in space and in time.
Travels in time?
When I have a long trip to make, I start the space drive and set the automatic pilot. Then I turn the time control forward to the estimated duration of the trip. And there I am. At my destination.
Well, that way you can do a year's traveling in a second.
More or less. Time travel is a little tricky, but very convenient for long-distance travel.
Yes, plenty convenient. But can you travel backwards in time?
Yes. The process is reversible. We could go back to that instant when you first saw the ship, if we wanted to.
And would I be standing there looking at you the way I was?
No, you'd be inside the ship, because you are now. So the past would be changed. Going back... Backwards is a bit tricky, you see. We seldom do it.
Mm. Now, Tony.
Yes?
Let me see. If I've got this straight, back on your planet, 15 years have passed since you left?
That's correct. And 15 more will pass before I get back, Joe. You humans are intelligent. And rather likable, judging from you. I do hope I won't have to take drastic measures on your world.
I learned something, but not much. We sped along, and there were the lights of the city underneath us, Los Angeles. Tony slowed down to study it. That's one of the cities I suppose you're going to have to blow up, isn't it, Tony?
Oh, I do hope I won't have to, Joe. Perhaps it can be avoided. What is that over there?
That looks like an amusement park.
An amusement park? I'd like to study that.
The ship came to a stop 100 feet in the air above a big amusement park right on the beach. Apparently, we couldn't be seen, but we could see and hear everything down below perfectly. First, Tony seemed interested in the rifle range. And next, he swooped down over an open-air dance platform where a band was playing, while 100 couples danced. Well, Tony, there you are. Human beings, enjoying themselves, having fun.
Having fun. Yes, your race has still the capacity to enjoy itself. We Thonians are very serious, I'm afraid.
You still think we're so bad, we humans?
Joe, I never said you were bad. But you may be dangerous. It's my job to find out. Now let us see some more of your world.
He pushed a button and the saucer leaped eastward across the continent. Beneath us, the mountains, the plains, the farmlands, forests, the lakes, and cities. Tony kept pushing buttons and I asked him what he was doing.
Why, Joe, I'm making a record. Sort of, what's your word? Yes, movie. A record of life on your world for our scientists to study.
I thought you said it was up to you to make the decision whether or not, you know, you were going to take action.
Oh, it is. This record is in case I do take action. Then, 1,000 years from now, our scientists can study these records and see if the new world you build after I... well, after I finish pruning, shall we say, is better than the old one.
I say to that. I kept my mouth shut. Suddenly, we were over New York. Tony slowed down the ship and brought it close to the ground. For a minute, we hovered there directly over Times Square, unseen. Directly under us was the usual snarl of traffic, of people coming and going, the big electric signs flashing, the heart of the world's greatest city beating. For a couple of seconds, we just sat and listened.
Your people have, Joe. What vitality. To what heights your race can climb.
If you let us.
If you let yourselves. Well, we must be going on.
He pushed another button. We swept onward. And I saw the world as no man has ever seen it before. All the beauty and wonder and misery and horror of it. In England someplace, we stopped long enough to watch a parade led by a band of Highland pipers. And then on across the rest of Europe. Tony seemed to like to see human beings enjoying themselves. But we visited Berlin, too, and there we stopped a minute. We saw a man and a woman suddenly jump from a window in East Berlin over that wall that they've erected and run for safety in West Berlin. And we saw what happened. Man and woman fell and lay there where they fell. Tony pushed the button. And then we were sweeping over barren wasteland, and suddenly Tony pointed.
Joe, look. See that?
I looked, and hundreds of miles away, I saw a tremendous burst of light, followed by the most enormous mushroom-shaped cloud the world has ever known. Tony pushed a button, and suddenly we were thousands of miles out in space, looking down at the Earth spinning underneath us.
Joe, that was an atomic explosion. A tremendous one.
Yeah, I read the Russians were planning to set off another big one.
I guess that about decides it, Joe. Right up to the end, I was hoping that mild corrective measures would be enough. I like you humans. You're full of laughter and vitality. And you can be kind and generous. But you're also full of cruelty and hate. You're a puzzling race, Joe. And our scientists will study these records for a long time.
Only we'll all be dead, huh?
No, not quite all of you. I leave a few of you to rebuild and hope they'll do a better job next time.
He pushed a switch. And down below us in 10,000 different spots, the Earth blew up. 10,000 cities and towns vanished. 10,000 times 10,000 people were gone as if they'd never existed. And that was when it happened. Last night. When you and you and you died. I had to tell you all this so you'd understand how you died. When it was over, Tony told me he'd put me back on Earth anywhere I wanted. And that's when the idea hit me. I asked him to put me down at the exact spot that he picked me up. He pushed a button, and we were back there hovering over that little California valley. And then I asked Tony to satisfy my curiosity to show me how his time travel gadget worked. In fact, I asked him just for a second to take me back to the very instant at 4 o'clock the day before when I'd first seen his ship. He agreed. He turned a dial. And all of a sudden, time turned backwards. It was the day before, and none of it had happened. You were all alive. The world was just as it had been. Everything was the same. Except one thing. The first time I had been outside the ship, and now I was inside. Everything else was exactly the same, including that 12 sticks of dynamite with the fuse sputtering. And now, the dynamite was going to go off because I wasn't outside to stamp out the fuse. And as we hovered there, it did. That explosion had ripped Tony's spaceship open, blew me out through a rip in the wall, and as I lay dazed on the ground, I saw the Thonian spaceship go spinning wildly around up into the sky and out into space, and I knew Tony must be dead, because his ship was a wreck, he'd have no air. So I'd fix things. The world was okay. We were all still alive. I'd tricked Tony. He hadn't known about the dynamite. All right. There you have it. The whole story. How you died last night and why you're still alive now. I had a broken ankle and a lot of bruises, but I rode Nellie back to town and told my story. And they laughed at me. I suppose you're laughing at me now, thinking I've made all this up just to entertain you. But you're wrong. You are wrong. Because out there in the stars is a race that doesn't think that we can be trusted. In 15 years, they'll wonder why Tony doesn't come back. They'll send someone else to find out. Just 15 years. Before then, we have got to prove they can trust us after all. We've got to act like human beings. We've got to live up to the best that's in us, not the worst. And we've only got 15 years. I only hope we can do it in time.
Suspense. You have been listening to You Died Last Night, starring Bob Reddick and Santos Ortega, and written especially for Suspense by Robert Arthur. Suspense is produced and directed by Bruno Zerato Jr. Music supervision by Ethel Huber. Sound patterns by Joseph Cabibbo. Listen again next week when we return with Let There Be Light, written by Irvin Lewis. Another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
A gripping tale of suspense from the world of sci-fi to your theater of the mind. That's CBS broadcast from April 1st, 1962. It's an hour of science fiction on Tuned to Yesterday with your host, Mark Levanier. And now on to Dimension X with the Ray Bradbury story, The Martian Chronicles, an August 18th, 1950 episode heard on NBC.
Tonight, Dimension X presents The Martian Chronicles, a dramatization of the new novel by one of our most brilliant young science fiction writers, Ray Bradbury. The Martian Chronicles. January in the year 1999. 1 minute it was Ohio winter with doors closed, the panes blind with frost, icicles fringing every roof, children skiing on snowy slopes. And then a long wave of warmth crossed the small town, a flooding sea of hot air.
Bye, Mom, I'm going out.
William McClellan, you come back here. You know you can't go out in winter without a coat. Do you want to catch your death of cold?
But it isn't cold. It's warm outside. It's rocket summer.
Rocket summer?
You know, like Indian summer.
The rocket lay on the launching field, blowing out pink clouds of fire and heat, cracking the icicles, melting the snow, making summer with every breath of its mighty exhausts. It seared the faces of the watching crowd and drove them back. And then they saw the red fire and heard the big sound as the silver rocket shot up toward Mars and left them behind on an ordinary Monday morning on the ordinary planet, Earth. They lived in a house of crystal pillars on the planet Mars by the edge of an empty sea. And every morning you could see Ila eating the golden fruits that grew from the crystal walls, or her husband sitting alone in his room reading from a singing metal book over which he brushed his hand as one might play a harp. Ila and her husband were not old. Once they had liked painting pictures with chemical fire, swimming in the canals when the wine trees filled them with green liquors and talking into the dawn together. But no more. Marriage sometimes makes people old and familiar while still young. And Ila was not happy now. This morning she sat dreaming between the crystal pillars and wished that somehow a miracle might happen. And then suddenly...
Ila, did you call?
No.
I thought I heard you cry out.
Did I? I was almost asleep and had a dream.
In the daytime? You don't often do that.
Strange. How very strange. I dreamed about a man. A tall man. 6 feet tall.
Oh, absurd. He'd be a giant, a misshapen giant.
I know. And yet, somehow he looked quite handsome. He was dressed in a strange uniform. And he came down out of the sky in a... long silver craft.
Out of the sky? What nonsense.
And he spoke pleasantly to me in another language. But somehow I understood him with my mind. Telepathy, I suppose.
A really ill.
And he said, I've come from the third planet in my ship. My name is Nathaniel York.
A stupid name. Whoever heard of a name like that?
Perhaps they have names like that on Earth.
That's ridiculous, Ila. Everyone knows the third planet is incapable of supporting life. There's too much oxygen in their atmosphere.
I suppose. But haven't you ever wondered if... Well, wouldn't it be fascinating if there were people there and they traveled through space in some sort of ship?
Really, Ila? You know I hate this emotional wailing. Now let's get on with our work.
Evening came. The twin white moons of Mars were rising, and the house closed itself in like a giant flower. A wind blew among the pillars, stirring Ila's russet hair, crooning softly in her ear. And it was then that she began singing the song.
Drink to me, only thine eyes, and I will with mine.
Ila, what's that song?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know? I've never heard it before. Did you compose it?
No. Yes. No, I don't know, really. I don't even know what the words are. They're in another language. It was part of the dream I had, I guess.
Oh. You know, you haven't been yourself lately. It might do you good if we went away to the Blue Mountains for a week or so.
What?
Did you hear what I said?
I'm sorry. I was watching the sky.
You're certainly interested in the sky tonight.
It's very beautiful.
Well, what about my suggestion? Shall we leave for the Blue Mountains in the morning?
You mean go away now? Oh, no.
No? Why not? Why don't you want to go?
I don't know. I just don't want to, that's all. Or leave a kiss in the cup and not ask
who... Ila, I'm sick of that silly song. It's late. Let us sleep.
From the crystal walls poured a soft carpeting of mist to support Ela where she lay down to sleep. But through the night she tossed restlessly until just at dawn the dream recurred.
Ela! Ela, wake up!
What? Oh, what is it?
You've been dreaming again. You talked in your sleep.
Did I?
Yes. What were you dreaming?
Oh, the ship. It came from the sky again. And the tall man stepped out and talked with me. Telling me little jokes and laughing.
What else happened?
And then this Captain York... Oh, I can't. It's all so silly.
Tell me!
He said I was beautiful. And then he kissed me.
I thought so. What else?
Why, Eel, you're so bad-tempered. It's only a dream.
Is it? You know I can read your mind. You can't keep secrets from me.
Well, all that happened was this Captain York told me... Well, he told me he'd take me away in his ship, into the sky. Take me back to his planet with him. It's quite ridiculous, really.
Ridiculous, is it? You should have heard yourself. Fawning on him, talking to him, singing with him all night. In your dream, he landed in Green Valley, didn't he?
Please.
And he told you he was coming today.
Yes. But what's come over you? It was only a dream. You can't be jealous of that.
No. No, I suppose not. Forgive me. I'm being childish.
Eel, you're sick. You've been working too hard.
No, I'm all right. But perhaps you're right. Maybe I could use a little relaxation.
Yes.
I think I'll take the morning off and go hunting.
Hunting?
Yes, in Green Valley.
Numbly, she watched him go to a closet and draw forth an evil-looking weapon. And then her husband was gone, walking toward Green Valley. And Ela waited, watching the sky for an unknown thing, trembling with a nameless fear. And then it happened. A whirring, rushing sound. The warmth as of a giant fire passing in the air. The gleam of metal in the sky.
He's come. It's true. The dream is true.
The rocket vanished over the hill. The sky was empty again. And trembling, Ela waited again, looking toward Green Valley and seeing nothing. Listening for sounds and hearing nothing. Until... A shot sounded. Very sharply, the sound of the evil weapon.
Oh, no. No.
Her body jerked with the sound, and she wanted to scream and never stop screaming. For now she knew the dream could never come true. There was nothing left but the song, the strange and fine and beautiful song.
Drink to me only with thine eyes, and I will pledge with mine, or leave a kiss within the cup.
But still the rockets came. The next ship came down from the stars and the black velocities and the silent gulfs of space and landed by night near a Martian city. The men made their way to the outer rim of the dreaming city, and then Jeff Spender went in to reconnoiter while the others watched and waited for something to stir in the haunted city, some gray form to rise, some voice to break the unearthly stillness. Where were the people? Where were the Martians? Nothing stirred to disturb the silence until...
Halt!
Who goes there?
Don't shoot!
Hold it, Parker. Let Spender and his party. They're coming back.
Captain Wells!
Over here!
Well? Captain, we've searched the city. People were living here last week.
People?
Martians.
Where are they now?
Dead.
Dead? What did they die of?
You won't believe it, Captain. Chickenpox.
Good Lord, no.
Yes. No resistance to an Earth disease, I guess.
So the other rocket did get through to Mars.
It looks like it, Captain. God only knows what the Martians did to them. But at least we know what they did to the Martians.
You mean they're all dead?
Yes. This planet is through.
Hey! You hear that, guys? We're safe! Break out a bottle, Cookie. Let's have a drink to celebrate.
Stop it, Parkhill. Put down that bottle.
What's eating you, Spender? The planet's ours now. We got to christen it, don't we? I christen thee the city of... Hey, Parkhill City.
Parkhill, I warned you!
All right, Spender, that's enough.
That'll cost you a $50 fine. Crookie, McClure, take care of Parkhill. Spender, you come with me. All right, Spender, why did you hit him?
I don't know, Captain. I was ashamed, I guess. Ashamed of Sam Parkhill and the noise and the spectacle the whole crew is making.
It's been a long trip. It's only natural they'd want to have their fling.
Yes, but where's their sense of what's right? Their respect for what's happened here? Captain, a race builds itself for a million years, refines itself, builds cities like this one, does everything it can to give itself respect and beauty, and then it dies. Of what? Not anything fine or majestic or fitting, but a dirty little thing like chicken pox. And Sam Parkhill wants to celebrate.
I know, Spender, but you've got to remember you've a different way of seeing things.
I'm seeing things all right. I'm seeing what we'll do to Mars. We'll rip it up, rip the skin off, ruin it the way we've ruined our own planet. Captain, look at the city. It may be the last time you'll ever see it this way.
Beautiful in the moonlight, isn't it?
Yes. There's a poem by Byron that describes it, and how the Martians would feel tonight, if there were any of them left to feel. So we'll go no more a-roving so late into the night. Though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright, for the sword outwears its sheath and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself must rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, yet we'll go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
Without a word, the Earthmen stood and looked at the city. The bottle lay shattered at Sam Parkhill's feet, and the sour stench of liquor filled the cool air. The men of Earth had come to Mars. Dimension X will continue in just a moment. It's National Wheaties Week. Yes, the week when everybody tries Wheaties, even an orchestra leader. And here he comes from behind the scenes in radio to help celebrate National Wheaties Week, Mr. Von Dexter.
Thank you, Frank. Hello, folks. I understand this is National Wheaties Week. I kind of get a kick out of that. The only breakfast food in the world with a week of its own. And I'm here for just one thing, to ask you to try Wheaties during National Wheaties Week. There are a lot of us whose voices you've never heard on the Wheaties' big parade of radio programs, you know. Backstage people.
Like musicians.
Right, Frank, like musicians. We'd get great pleasure from knowing you like these programs well enough to buy a box of Wheaties tomorrow. Wheaties are good. They're nice to eat. I like them. I think you will. Try them once during National Wheaties Week. Will you do that?
Vaughn, I think the folks will.
Good. Thank you. Good night.
The men of Earth came to Mars. They came because they were afraid or unafraid, because they were happy or unhappy, because they felt like pilgrims or did not feel like pilgrims, The government posters screamed, "There's work for you in the sky. See more." And the men shuffled forward, all kinds of men, all coming for different reasons. The rockets came like drums beating in the night. They came like locusts, swarming and settling in blooms of rosy smoke. Mars was a distant shore, and the settlers spread upon it in waves. First the pioneers and builders, then the people of civilization. Some came because they were afraid of a coming war on Earth. Some came because they were afraid of nothing. Some came to escape from the smell of the subways and the cabbage tenements. And some came from houses like the one in Ohio. It was a good house, the house in Ohio. And for 6 years, the family had lived there contentedly, enjoying music and poetry and the rich, warm things of life. For the house had been built to be lived in the year 2020. It contained all the latest automatic devices, from talking book recorders to singing clocks. As the family rose and dressed, the beds whirred electronically and made themselves. In the kitchen, the stove sighed and ejected from its warm interior 8 eggs, sunny side up, 12 bacon slices, 2 coffees, and 2 glasses of milk.
7-9, breakfast time. Come and dine. 7-9.
Beside the breakfast table, the facsimile machine clacked and deposited the morning paper on the table. The headlines today spoke ominously of the danger of a coming war. And the man frowned as he read the news.
Today is August 4th, 2026. Insurance, gas, and atom heat bills are due. And today, remember, the family has planned a picnic.
Gee, Dad, are we really going?
Sure, Timmy, why not?
It's raining out.
It's not raining where we're going, son. Now run upstairs, pack your fishing tackle. We're going on our picnic, all right.
Okay, Dad.
Bill, are you sure we ought to go?
Yes. Have you seen the headlines this morning?
Looks bad, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. The rocket's ready. All we have to do is pack and take off.
I know, but... Well, flying to Mars, it seems so crazy. Well, all right, then we'll go. Should we tell the children why we're going?
No, not yet. Let them enjoy the picnic.
The house went on with its appointed tasks.
9:15, time to clean. 9:15, time to clean.
Out of the molding darted hundreds of tiny mechanical mice, all rubber and metal. They sucked up the dust and dirt in the house and popped back into their burrows. In the walls, relays clicked, memory tapes glided under electric eyes, recorded voices moved under steel needles.
12 o'clock. 6 o'clock, tick-tock, 8 o'clock.
Evening came. In the living room, the hearth fire bloomed out of nothing, and the phonograph spoke from beside the fireplace.
Mrs. McClellan, what poem would you like to hear this evening? Mr. McClellan, since you express no preference, I shall select at random from among your favorites. Sarah Teasdale, There Will Come Soft Rain.
There will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sound, and frogs in the pool singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire, and not one will know of war, not one will care at last when it is done. Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly, and spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone.
The phonograph finished the poem, but there was no one there to hear, for the family had gone to Mars. Ah! Ah! On the Martian desert beside the highway, there rose a blare of red and yellow neon lights that spelled the death of Jeff Spender's dream. Sam's hot dog stand was what the sign read. And Sam, of course, was the same Sam Parkhill who had fought with Spender years before. 10,000 rockets were reported leaving soon for Mars, with 100,000 hungry customers. And Sam wanted to be ready for them.
Hey, look up there, Elmer. Huh? See that green star up there? That's Earth. Good old wonderful Earth. Makes you feel almost reverent, don't it?
Yeah.
Sam, you're hungry and you're starved. Something. That's a poem I learned at school. Come on, Earth, send me your rockets. Here's Sam Parkhill with the only hot dog stand on Mars.
Sam, what if the rockets don't come? What if there's a war on Earth?
Ah, don't worry. They're coming all right. Ain't nothing going to happen to spoil my plans, baby. I figured it all out.
Sam! Hey, Sam, look up there. Earth!
Well, where? Oh, no.
It's catching fire. It's burning.
Oh, no, that can't be Earth. Elmer, they can't do this to me. I got all our money invested in this place.
Go ahead, Sam. Switch on more lights. Turn up the music. Get the hot dogs on the fire. There'll be another batch of customers coming along in about 100 million years.
Oh, no, it couldn't be.
What a swell spot for a hot dog stand. Let you in on a little secret, Sam. This looks like it's going to be an off season.
The light beam radio crackled with the news. By morning, the shelves of the luggage store were empty, and the rockets were blasting off, headed back to Earth. In a few days, everyone was gone, and the planet of Mars once more lay deserted and silent. And then, after all the rest had gone, one last rocket landed on Mars. A small, family-sized rocket come all the way from Earth. It seemed a long way to go for a picnic, but Dad had suggested a fishing trip, and Mother thought the whole family would enjoy a vacation. So here they were, floating down a Martian canal, with Timothy sitting in the back of the boat with Dad and Mother up front holding Alice the baby, and the deserted Martian towns drifting slowly by.
Dad.
What is it, Timmy?
When do we see the Martians? You promised we would.
Soon, Tim, soon.
Oh, but William, the last Martians died out years ago. They're a dead race now.
Not quite. Don't worry, son. I'll show you some real live Martians later on.
Gee, this is swell. I wish we didn't ever have to go home. How long can we stay?
1 million years.
1 million years?
Yes. It's time we told you, son. We're not going home. This is where we'll live from now on.
But what about the rocket? What about Ohio?
There's nothing there now but ruins. The last Earth radio just went off the air. That means the war is over and Earth is finished. We're going to blow up our rocket and start all over. See if we can't build a better world up here.
You mean Mars is going to be our home?
Yes. I hope you don't mind too much.
No, sir. But what about the Martians? When do we get to see them?
There they are, son. Look down at the water.
I don't see anything there.
Beside the boat. Look at the reflections in the water.
But that's us down there. Just you and me and Mom and the baby.
Yes, son. You see, we're the Martians now.
For a long, silent moment, Timmy stared down at the reflections of the family in the waters. And the Martian stared back up at him. Then he lifted his eyes to the deep ocean sky, trying once more to see Earth and the house he had always called home. But Earth was too far away, and the house was now only a heap of radioactive rubble. Only one wall remained standing, and within the wall a voice spoke again and again and again.
Not one would mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. and spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we were gone, 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 that we were gone.
2026. Today is October 5th, 2026.
You have just heard The Martian Chronicles, a dramatization of highlights from the new novel by Ray Bradbury. Your narrator was Norman Rose, and featured in the cast were Inga Adams, Roger DeCoven, and Donald Buca. Music by Albert Berman, engineer Bill Chambers. Dimension X is produced by Van Woodward and directed by Jack Cuney.
Next week, the strange and chilling story of The Parade. The parade that suddenly turned into a funeral procession for the world of tomorrow. The world of...
Dimension X.
The preceding was transcribed. Coming up is Jack Late. Listen for Bill Bendix, October 6th on NBC.
Selections from The Martian Chronicles on Tuned to Yesterday, heard on Dimension X on August 18, 1950 on NBC, from the collection of short stories published in the late 1940s in various sci-fi magazines covering January 1999 through October of 2057. And that wraps this hour of sci-fi on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great shows from the golden age of radio. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. It's been a pleasure.